All right, let's pray. Father, I do seek your face right now as we open up your word. I pray that you would bless it, bless your people, bless everything that we do, and teach us the things that are written here for our learning and for our edification. And we ask these things in Jesus Christ's precious name. Amen. All right, so many, many years ago, I preached this sermon that I intend to do again this morning, and somebody recently said, do it again, and so I said, yes, okay, I'll do it again. And I'm going to call this Unstable as Water. Why don't we begin in Genesis chapter 49 and read a short passage there, and then I'll share some ideas with you, and we'll eventually turn to a bunch more scriptures as well. But beginning in Genesis chapter 49, it says, And Jacob called unto his sons and said, gather yourselves together that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days. Gather yourselves together and hear, ye sons of Jacob, and hearken unto Israel your father. Reuben, thou art my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, and the excellency of power. Unstable as water, thou shalt not excel, because thou wentest up to thy father's bed, then defilest thou it. He went up to my couch. Jacob goes through this chapter, and he goes through all 12 of his sons, and he says something specific about each of his 12 sons. His firstborn, that Leah, his first wife that he didn't actually intend to marry but was forced on him, his firstborn son was Reuben. He starts with Reuben, and he calls Reuben the beginning of my strength. But instead of Reuben being what he was designed by God to be, he became something different. And so Jacob had to tell him that he was not going to succeed in life because he wasn't stable. Now, we go back a few chapters. I'm not going to turn there, but you guys know the story of creation. God created the earth, and it was covered with water. And then he makes the dry land appear out of the water. This is the beginning stage of the creation of God. When God created these things, every step he went through, as he went, he said, he looked at what he had done, it was good. Everything he had done was good. Water basically was the first thing that we had on earth. It preceded any other thing on earth, water. And God looked at water and he said it was good. But after he goes through and he makes the sun and the moon and the stars and the plants and the trees and the animals, and then he finally at the end creates man. He creates man in his own image. And all the way down the line he had gone, he had made everything, and everything that he had made was good. But man was special. Man wasn't just good. He was special in that God had made him like himself. He had given him properties, let's say, of what he was made out of. And if we are going to take man and compare him, as we oftentimes do, to any single thing that had preceded him in the creation of God, man has utterly descended and forsaken the position that God had made him to be when he created him. Every single piece of the creation that God had made up until man was not like God. Okay? Then he made man to be like God. And so when Jacob has to turn to his son and say, you are like water, Reuben had fallen from the position that God had created Reuben to be. Now, the fact of the matter is, it is the state of the whole ungodly world right now that they are described of by God as being like water. It's the state of humanity. So let me describe some things to you, because we need to understand what water is. First of all, I said already, water was good. When God created water, it was good. There is no earth as we know it without water. It is the most necessary element that we have on earth to sustain life. It is the thing that differentiates our planet Earth from all the other planets that we know anything about, is that we have water here on this planet. And it is absolutely necessary to have that water to have any form of life. So water is good, but water has a very specific propriety in that it is unstable. Water does not do anything. Everything that you ever see water accomplish is accomplished by a force outside of itself working on it. So, for example, okay, you guys, I'm not a scientist right now, so forgive me if I say something kind of unscientific, but it'll be the truth anyway. So we have on Earth two major differentiations of surface on Earth. We have Earth and we have water. And up above, the sun shines, and the sun bakes the Earth, and it would be absolutely lifeless and dead and crusty and dry and worthless to any purpose on Earth were it not for the fact that we keep that Earth wet with the water that is in another location on the Earth. So the sun shines down from heaven, and it exercises evaporating properties on that water. Water evaporates, it goes up into the sky, it gets blown around the Earth with wind that also the sun is the author of creating. The sun makes the wind, so the sun evaporates the water and creates the wind, and it blows the evaporated water all around the world. And now my knowledge stops. I don't know how it comes back down. Something happens eventually that water forms into rain, and it comes back down on the earth, and it waters the ground. And this goes on 365 days a year. The sun is always working this system. This is the sustaining power of life on Earth that the sun creates. And so we see water go up and we see water come down. And when the water comes down, it gets everything wet that it comes on, then it forms itself into whatever is excess that isn't used by man or animals or plants. It forms itself into rivers that run back into the seas, where it will evaporate again and come back again and descend on the earth again, and over and over and over and over the cycle goes. Millions and millions and millions of times the rain comes down, it goes into the seas, it comes up, it waters the land, and so on. Every single thing that you see water do, it was not responsible for. It was acted on by a force outside of itself. Now, this is the primary difference between the creation of water and the creation of man, that why man should never be like water. Because God made us to be holy like himself. He created us with the knowledge of the difference between right and wrong. We own that inside of us. We understand the difference between right and wrong without even reading the Bible. We understand the difference. It's in our conscience. He created us to know the difference between right and wrong. He created us to stand up for right. He created us to do right. He created us to be like God, where we would be good people. And instead, we allow forces outside of ourselves to demoralize us to the point that we become worthless in life, to the point where we cannot be successful in the basic elements of life because we chose not to be like God. Instead, we chose to be worked on by other forces. So what happened? This is the basic idea of water. We'll go a little bit more into that later, but I want to look at Reuben. What happened in the life of Reuben? Why Jacob says these awful words about him? Thou shalt not excel. What was Reuben? Well, Jacob specifically mentions that Reuben went and lay with one of his wives. All right. Okay, now, how many of you guys realize that today in the United States of America, Reuben was normal? He was normal. How many of you guys understand in your heart that if your son, if one of your grown son went and slept with his mother, he would be wrong? How many of you guys understand that inside? Does that make sense? All right? How come Reuben did that? We don't know. We don't know the story. I'll read it to you just so you know, just so you can see exactly what the scripture says about it. It's in Genesis chapter 35. Genesis chapter 35 and verse 22 says, "And it came to pass when Israel dwelt in that land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard it." That's all it says. Now, I happen to know a little bit about guys and girls and about the relationship, how things work between guys and girls. And I happen to know that there would be a reason that Reuben would have done something like this. Because Reuben, being a male with normal attractions to female, saw this woman who belonged to his father. This wasn't actually his mother, okay? It was one, because Jacob had four wives. He shouldn't have, but he did. He had four wives. So this was one of Jacob's wives. It wasn't actually his mother. Leah was his mother. He saw this woman and he said, you know, I think that woman would be fun to do something with. And somehow it didn't matter to him that he had no business with her because she belonged to somebody else. And it didn't matter to him that God had made him to be like himself, who was pure and holy and didn't do things that were ridiculous and wrong. That didn't matter to him. And so he went and did what he was feeling like doing, what the influence, outside influence, was coming on him from a woman. That's what he did. Now, every single time that a man on this earth touches or plays with or has an immoral relationship with a woman who is not his wife, he is in exactly the same place that Reuben was on that day, where a temptation from outside of himself caused him to do something wrong that God says is wrong and that he himself would have known was wrong had he thought for 1 minute about it. He would have known it was wrong. And that influence from outside of himself caused him to do something he should not have done, and it wrecked his life because he was willing to say yes to pleasure instead of yes to right. It wrecked his life because he made the choice to do what was the thing that he felt like doing rather than what was the right thing for him to do. It wrecked his life. Now, Jacob did not say about Reuben, "You are an absolute scoundrel, wicked, horrible thing that never thought a right thought or did a right thing." That's not what he said. He said, "Reuben, thou art my firstborn, my might, the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, the excellency of power. But you also did this." So now we see Reuben, a good man and a bad man. So now we don't see Reuben as being a good man or a bad man, but he's unstable. He does some of both. He flops back and forth. He'd be good one day, he'd be bad another day. Good one day, bad another day. And so Jacob says, "You're unstable as water." Now, this isn't the only time we see this kind of attitude in Reuben. The other major story about him is with his brother Joseph, and you'll find that in Genesis chapter 42. Joseph happened to be Jacob's favorite son. He was the first son of Rachel, the woman Jacob really wanted to marry when he got forced to marry Leah. He was the firstborn son of Rachel, and Jacob took a liking to Joseph above and beyond the liking that he showed the rest of his children. Maybe Jacob was wrong for that. Maybe that created some havoc in the family. But beside the point, we're talking now about the fact that there's 12 sons in this family. Joseph is a favored son, and he comes. Jacob sends him to go visit his older brothers, who are out with the flocks, and in the 18th verse of Genesis chapter 42, we begin in the middle of that story. That's my next chapter we're going to. It's chapter 37 we want to be in right now. Chapter 37 and verse 18. Joseph is coming now to his brothers. And it says, and when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. Now, I could ask this question again. I'm not waste the time. If I said to you guys, how many of you guys think that it is wrong to kill your brother? You all know that. You don't need to go. None of you guys have ever gone and read the laws of the United States. Nobody here has ever done that. It's illegal to murder in this country, okay? You know that in your head, but you've never gone and read those laws. And if there was no such law in this country, you still would believe it was wrong to kill your brother, because God created you with that belief. Because we know inside that it's not right to kill our brother. But here these 10 brothers are, that they see Joseph coming, and they decide before he gets to them that they're going to kill him. And they said one to another, behold, this dreamer cometh. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him and cast him into some pit, and we will say, some evil beast hath devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. And Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said unto them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again. And it came to pass, when Joseph was come unto his brethren, that they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colors that was on him, and they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty, there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels, bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said unto his brethren, what profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brethren were content. Then there passed by Midianites, merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph into Egypt. And Reuben returned unto the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit. And he rent his clothes, and he returned unto his brethren and said, the child is not, and whither shall I go? Now, how many of you guys, if you were in a position where, okay, you have multiple brothers and sisters, and a bunch of your brothers and sisters don't like one specific one, and they say, let's steal $1 million from this brother, okay? Let's steal $1 million from him. And what would you think if you said to those brothers, listen, let's not be that rude to him. Let's not steal $1 million. Let's just steal 100. That's what Reuben did. Reuben did not stand up for his brother. He didn't do what was right. If Reuben had done what was right in this passage, he would have said, you guys are not going to touch him. We are going to leave him 100% alone. We are going to treat him with respect. And I am going to protect him against all of you. Don't lay a finger on him. That's what would have been the right thing, the only right thing for Reuben to have done. But instead, he compromised with them on their level trying to make both his father and his brothers happy. So instead of being a man of God, he becomes a man who wants to please everybody around him. Going to please my brothers. Instead of killing him, I'm going to convince him just to throw him into a pit, because later I can go get him out of the pit and send him back to his father, who I also need to please. This is what you see in the life of a person who's unstable, is that they are more concerned about doing what is good in the eyes of the people around them and making things work with the people around them than they are about what is right before God. God did not create us to be accountable to man. He created us to be accountable to him. God did not set any authority over Adam and Eve in the garden, but himself. Okay? He did not make us to please the government or our friends or our enemies or our wife or our husband. He made us to please himself, and he made us to be people who we are moral creatures. We are not like the animals who have no morality built into them. Man is a moral creature, and God created us with that specifically built into us because he made us like himself. Because according to God, there is a difference between right and wrong based on love. So, Reuben completely failed here to do what was right, and he tried instead to do what would please his brothers and please his father, so making himself the one who is going to be influenced from all sources. And he failed, because undoubtedly, the story doesn't detail here, but he convinced his brothers to cast him into a pit, intending to go get him out. But while Reuben apparently is off from the rest of his brothers, he's probably very distressed and doesn't know what to do, and he's off taking a walk somewhere, and his brothers see this company coming by, and they're like, hey, why don't we make some profit off getting rid of our brother? We'll just sell him to them and let them take him away. And Reuben's not there when they do it. He comes back to the pit after Joseph has been pulled out and sold and gone. He comes back to the pit and looks in, and Joseph is gone. And he says, now what am I going to do? You know, these brothers have to face Joseph again later, and that's in chapter 42. And we're not going to read all of this here, but we'll read a couple of verses out of chapter 42. When Joseph goes down to Egypt, if you remember the story, he gets sold into slavery. He eventually becomes, under Pharaoh, the chief ruler of the land of Egypt, because Joseph was successful, because he was different than Reuben, because Joseph had a moral code that he would not break. So every single thing that Joseph did in life, he differentiated between right and wrong based on what he knew of God, what he knew to be right, and he said no to things that were wrong, and he said yes to things that were right. And so he gets cast into prison because he said no to his master's wife when she asked him to lay with her. She came asking him when they two were alone in the house, come and lay with me. And he said, no, I can't do this. I'm not going to sin against your husband. I'm not going to sin against God. And so she makes up a bad story about him because he wouldn't do what she asked him to do. Now, what do you think Reuben would have done in that situation? He would have fallen flat on his face. But Joseph stood up for what was right. He did right. And because he stood up for what was right, he got himself into trouble. And she made up a story about him, and he ends up going to prison. So in the prison, he continues to do all the things that are right in the prison, because that's who Joseph was. And so in the prison, he's made, though he is a prisoner, he's put in charge of the prison. Then he gets brought out of the prison and introduced to Pharaoh, and is able to interpret through the power of God. He's able to interpret some dreams that Pharaoh has, and he gets put in charge of the empire, basically, under Pharaoh. And so now they grew lots and lots of food. There's a famine now all over the earth, and in Egypt there's food because Joseph grew it and put it into barns and saved it. And so the brothers, Joseph's brothers, have to go down to Egypt now to get food because they've run out in the land where they are. And they come and face Joseph, who is in charge of the distribution of the food. They don't know it's his brother. They don't know that Joseph is their brother. And this is in chapter 42 of Genesis. And we read in verse 18, it says, "And Joseph said unto them the third day, This do and live, for I fear God. If ye be true men, let one of your brethren be bound in the house of your prison. Go ye, carry corn for the famine of your houses, but bring your youngest brother unto me, so shall your words be verified, and ye shall not die." And they did so. And they said one to another, "We are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us." The brothers are talking to Joseph through an interpreter. They don't know that he's Joseph. He's speaking his new Egyptian language. They don't know he's their brother. He's hearing everything they say. And they're in distress because Joseph knows them, and so he's intentionally being hard on them. And so he says, "You're not coming back unless you bring your youngest brother." This would be Benjamin, who hadn't come with them. He said, "You can't come and see my face again unless you bring your younger brother." And so he puts them in prison, and then he gets them out, and he says, "Listen, I fear God. Go take this food back for your families, and I'm going to keep one of you guys bound here in the prison, and you go back and bring your younger brother back so I'll know that you guys aren't spies, that you're really honest men, and then I'll let you all go." And as they sit in this stressful place in a foreign country where they're being abused by the leader of the country, let's say, they think back and remember that day that their brother Joseph showed up in the field where they were and how he begged them not to hurt him, and they would not listen to him. And they say among themselves, "We are verily guilty concerning our brother." And listen to what Reuben says in the next verse. "And Reuben answered them, saying, Spake I not unto you, saying, Do not sin against the child? And ye would not hear. Therefore, behold, also his blood is required." Do you understand the difference now? There is 10 brothers here standing in front of Joseph. They don't know it's Joseph. And they, 9 of these brothers, are admitting guilt for what happened to Joseph. And Reuben is blaming them as though he were innocent himself. This is Reuben. Why doesn't Reuben take and blame himself as being the oldest brother in charge of the crew and the one who should have stood up as a man of God in the situation and said, "You are not touching this guy"? Why didn't he stand up at that moment and take all the blame on himself and say, "I am the problem. I am the bad one. It is my fault you guys are in this situation"? That's what Reuben should have done. And that would have been repentance. Instead of repenting here, when his other 9 brothers are feeling repentance, he blames them. This is Reuben. Now, go down, drop a few verses down to verse 36. They go back to Jacob. And it says in verse 36, "And Jacob their father said unto them, Me ye have bereaved of my children. Joseph is not." He thought Joseph was dead because they never, even though the brothers knew the truth about what happened to Joseph, they never told their father. They lied to him about it. So Jacob believed Joseph was dead. So he says, "Joseph is not, and Simeon is the one they bound in prison, and Simeon is not. And ye will take Benjamin away? All these things are against me." And listen to what Reuben says. "And Reuben spake unto his father, saying, Slay my 2 sons, if I bring him not to thee. Deliver him into my hand, and I will bring him to thee again." Why does Reuben say to his father, "Kill my 2 sons," instead of "Kill me, if I don't bring Benjamin back"? How come Reuben is offering his sons to die for his sin if he fails to bring Benjamin back? That's not what he should have said. Why should his sons have borne the brunt of the problem if Reuben had failed in the thing that he intended to do? Because the brothers wanted to go back to Egypt for more corn, but they said, we can't go back unless we bring Benjamin. And Jacob didn't want Benjamin to go. And so Reuben is trying to take responsibility for Benjamin. Say, like, you can kill my children if I don't bring them back. That's not what we would do for a person who failed. We would not blame the children for the failure of a father if he didn't accomplish the thing that needed to be done. This is Reuben. He's not a man with a high level of moral sense, but he was supposed to be, because that's how God had made him. Because God had made him to be the firstborn, the might, the beginning of strength, the excellency of dignity, and the excellency of power. That's what God had intended Reuben to be when God had created Reuben. But Reuben had failed to listen to God, and instead he had followed the lusts of the flesh, and he had become a fool in life. That's the story of the human race. So Jacob had to tell him, unstable as water, thou shalt not excel. Now let me just describe a few things to you quickly in the story of water. You know water? You know what water is? What water does? It's an interesting thing what water is. I don't know how to describe it, but water always takes the path of least resistance in everything that it does. You would think that it appears almost sometimes like water works against nature in the things that it does, but it always does the thing that is easiest. So for example, up here, way at the top of Wisconsin, whichever way north is from here, way up at the top of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin River starts. And it winds its way all the way down to Prairie du Chien, down at near the southwest corner of the state, and empties into the Mississippi River. The exact miles between those two spots is about 238 miles by air. But the Wisconsin River is 420 miles long. All right? So the Wisconsin River takes about 200 extra miles to get from point A to point B. Why does it do that? Because it takes the path of least resistance. It's never willing to climb a hill, ever. The entire 420 miles from point A to point B, it never climbs one hill. The only thing the river will ever do is flow down. And because it will only ever flow down, it cares nothing about where it goes, just simply wherever the next place is that is down. That's where it's going. Now, how many of you guys think that human beings should be like water? Does that sound like what we should be? Is just the path of least resistance the thing that's the easiest to do? Why should we ever be anything like water? It's good, and when God made creation, he made it very beautiful. And the fact that water does this is the fact that we have life, because when rivers run, and they run thousands and thousands, millions of miles extra across this globe than they need to run to do what they do, they water the land. And that's what water was made to do, but that's not what man was made to be like. Man was made to be, in the image of God, a moral creature that knew the difference between right and wrong and treated humans right and treated God right. That's how man was made. But here, with water, so the thing that works on water to make it always go down is gravity. But do you realize that water oftentimes goes up? So try this once. Take a perfectly dry 2x4 and a 5-gallon pail of water, and stand the 2x4 up 8 feet tall in the in the pail of water, take a moisture meter, check the reading on the dry end out of the water, come back 2 weeks later and check it again. What you will experience is that water went up. And as much as is in the ability of that piece of wood to hold moisture, it is going to be a wet piece of wood because it worked on the water also. And instead of water wanting to go down, water went up. Here's another example. You could bring a 5-gallon pail of water into this room right now, and you could dump it across the floor right here. Splash. Close all the windows in the building. Make sure all the fans are off in the bathroom. As little possible airflow between the inside and the outside of the building as possible. And you could come back here a week later, and you could feel the spot on the floor where you dumped the 5-gallon pail of water, and it would be basically dry. Why? Because water goes down, right? Where would the water go? And let me tell you something. You wouldn't be able to find that water, except you would feel like it was damp in here. And that water would be in the chairs. It would be in the wood of this pulpit. It would be in the drywall on the walls. It would be in the piano, destroying the soundboard. It would be all over the room. Everything that is in this room that is capable of attracting humidity would have gotten a little piece of that water into itself. The water would be all over the room without ever having done anything on its own, because it's acted upon by forces outside of itself. Water does that. It's a good thing, actually, because that ability of water to become a vapor and to enter into other things sustains life on Earth. Small amounts of water do that. Large amounts of water do something different. When you put small amounts of water out in a place, it will turn into vapor and it will go into all the things around it, and it will make everything around it wetter than it was. But the more amount of water you have in one location, the more that water will congregate at the lowest place available. Did you know that's a picture of the human race right now without God? The congregation of the masses of humanity on this earth congregating together at the lowest place they can find to sit morally. Go to Isaiah chapter 57. And it says in verse 20, "But the wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked." This is God's description of humanity on earth, apart and separated from God. They are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. Water in small quantity has no force. It's acted on by everything around it. It's mild. It doesn't do much. You'd never ever be scared of water in small quantity. But when you get water in large quantity, when we start talking about the ocean, it is absolutely devastating in its effects. It is a terrible place to be. There's nothing safe about the ocean. All day long, all night long, 365 days a year, year after year after year after year after year, the waves of the ocean roll over and over and over and over and over as the sea never quits moving. The congregation of waters in the lowest available place that they can find to sit on earth. That is what God compares the ungodly to. Because when we depart from who God made humans to be and we allow other things to influence us other than only God, that is what we become. And that is what the nations of the earth together in the sight of God right now sit as. Like the ocean, whose violence is nonstop going on all the time. A horrible and dangerous place to be. So, Jacob says to Reuben, unstable as water, thou shalt not excel. It wasn't the fact that Reuben had no good in him. He had been created with all the good that God could have given him. But he had left it and he had chosen to do things that were wrong. So he was unstable like water. Unstable as water, thou shalt not excel. This principle is spoken of in the New Testament very clearly. And I've got three passages I want to turn to quickly before we quit. In James chapter 1, we start in James chapter 1, and verse 8 only, it just says, a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. What is a double-minded man? A double-minded man is somebody like Reuben who wants to please both his brothers and his father. That's what a double-minded man. A double-minded man is somebody who gets conflicting information or conflicting purposes from multiple sources. So I want to protect Joseph from his brothers because I need to get him safely home to his father. But I also am unwilling to stand up and call my brothers wrong and tell them that they shouldn't hurt the boy. So I'm going to agree with them that we should harm him in a lesser way so that I can ultimately win and get him back to his father. Did he win? He didn't. He lost him. Because he played with nine other brothers whose hearts were wicked inside of them, who wanted to murder their brother. He sided with them and helped them in their aims, and he lost his chief purpose, which was to save his brother. A double-minded man is unstable. Now, Jesus says something in Matthew chapter 6 regarding a very specific thing, money, specifically. In Matthew chapter 6, we'll read a couple verses. Beginning in verse 22, he says, the light of the body is the eye. If therefore the eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. But if thine eye be evil, thy whole body shall be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in thee be darkness, how great is that darkness? No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. Ye cannot serve God and mammon. This is the principle that he is speaking of here in these verses applies to all areas of life. But he specifically specifies that you human beings sitting in this room right now, you do not have the ability. It's not that it's going to be hard. You don't physically have the ability to serve both God and money. If God's going to be your God, then money cannot be a God. And if money is going to be your God, then you will never please God. You don't have the ability. It's not, Jesus didn't give it out like it's unlikely to happen. He said you can't. It's not possible to happen. Anybody who is going to elevate money to the place of a God cannot serve God. Now, let's go to a more general passage in Galatians chapter 5, and we'll read a few verses in 5 and 6. In Galatians, showing us the same principle, the flesh and the spirit. Let's begin in verse 13 of chapter 5. For brethren, ye have been called unto liberty, only use not liberty for an occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. But if ye bite and devour one another, take heed that ye be not consumed one of another. This I say then, walk in the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. For the flesh lusteth against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary the one to the other, so that ye cannot do the things that ye would. But if ye be led of the Spirit, ye are not under the law. Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness, revelings, and such like, of the which I tell you before, as I have told you in time past, that they which do these things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. Now, Paul, writing to the Galatians here, teaching them the difference between the flesh and the Spirit, he says you have to walk in the Spirit. If you don't want to fulfill the lusts of the flesh, you have to walk in the Spirit. We'll get to a little bit deeper on that in just a moment. But in talking about the flesh and the Spirit, it's like these two things are armies that are at war against each other. There's never peace between them. The flesh and the Spirit don't agree with each other, and they don't get along. He says it this way in verse 17, the flesh lusteth against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary the one to the other. Okay, so the flesh and the Spirit do not get along. They are opposed to each other. And how many of you guys think that a moral human being could serve two different armies? Like, let's say this was the Civil War right now, and you were going to fight on the side of the North and the South. Can you guys do that? Can you fight on both sides? What if you're trying to be a Christian, and you are going to let both the flesh and the Spirit rule in your life? That is just as impossible as being on two different sides of the war. You're going to have to oppose the flesh, or you're going to live by the flesh, and you're going to oppose the Spirit. And some people who are unstable are going to try to do both, but they're going to fail just like Reuben failed. That's the outcome of the person who wants to both serve the flesh and the Spirit, is that they're going to fail like Reuben failed. But now, let's go to verse 6 and continue to understand what he's talking about a little bit here. Chapter 6 and verse 7 says, be not deceived, God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. For he that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. But he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. Now, stop and think for a minute. We're planting. We're in a field right now and we're planting. And there's two masters over us that want us to grow two different crops. One of them says, plant flesh. Or the flesh says, plant for me. And the Spirit says, plant for me. And you say, listen, I like you, the flesh, and I like you, the Spirit. You have a place when I want to be naughty, and you have a place when I need to be good. I'm going to serve both of you. And I'm going to take these seeds over here, and I'm going to plant this half of my field to the flesh, and I'm going to plant this half of my field to the Spirit. And what is the harm? Because these little seeds go into the ground, they get buried with soil, nobody sees what I did. And it's done. You know, when we sow, reaping comes at a later date. And man can go on living in sin for many, 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 many years without experiencing a lot of the consequences of the choices that he is making. But the time will come, absolutely the time will come, where those seeds that were planted will grow and bring forth a harvest. And the end of sowing to the spirit, the end of sowing to the flesh is death. And the end of sowing to the spirit is everlasting life. And you say, this is hard because, and I know it is, this is the truth, because inside of us, we have this drawing to sin that God says no about. And God calls us to serve him in truth. And so serving God in truth sounds like an easy thing to do until the flesh knocks on the door and says, hey, I need you to do this today. And you have to say no to the flesh. In fact, we have to just kill the flesh and let it go. Goodbye. I'm staying over here 100%. And that's where it becomes a battle. The war starts raging. The spirit and the flesh aren't going to get along here. And we have to take the side of the spirit and tell the flesh to go. So, you say, I don't know if I can do this. Listen to what Paul says. The Spirit of God, through Paul, says. After he says, he that soweth to the flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption, but he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. And let us not be weary. Those are his next words. Because he knew every person that read these things and tried to implement these things in their life would get discouraged by it because sometimes it's a hard road. And so then his next words are, let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. It's not, you see, today, if I decide today that I'll do a little bit of compromise with a little bit of wrong, that I'll do a few things that aren't right, but I'll mostly live for God, and I'm going to bury those seeds under the soil where all my church friends don't know anything about it, and I'm going to live in peace. I can say this today, but tomorrow the crop starts to grow, and in a little while it starts to bring forth fruit, and in a little while, the things that I did become a part of my life in the production that happened through them. And then they start to take me down. And you can get in your head, if you want to, you can get in your head that you can play with sin a little bit, but you can't. If you are going to live for God, you're going to have to be done with sin. 100% done. Because according to Jesus, you can't serve two masters. Now, I hope I painted a picture here of the difference between how God created man to be versus how we've chosen to be. We've chosen that when our friends come and invite us to do something wrong with them, we go. God made us to look them in the face and say, one day you're going to have to give an account to God for the way you lived your life. And if you live in this kind of sin that is directly against the work and the word of God, you're going to face the judgment of God, and I'm not going with you. That's what God made us to be. God made us to be like him. He made us to be strong. He made us to uphold the difference between right and wrong. He gave us a backbone. He made us moral creatures where there is a difference between right and wrong. And he told us to do right. And instead, all the forces of nature come against us and they work on us. And when we aren't going to have God and God only in our lives, we become like water. Where when God is working on us, we'll do right. And when Satan is working on us, we'll do wrong. And that person will never succeed. Every person in this room has to make a choice. And your choice is going to consist of something super, super simple. God is the only and ultimate one that you are pleasing. That's your choice. That will keep you from being like water. It'll make you do the right thing no matter what's happening. It'll put you in the path of fellowship with God. It'll keep you from sin. It'll keep you out of trouble. But you'll have to have a backbone if you're going to live that way. Let's close with prayer. Father, I do ask that you would lead each one of us in your will. I pray that these words from the Bible here would sink into our hearts and our souls and teach us the difference between right and wrong and make us what you would have us to be, men of love and truth. We ask these things through Jesus' precious name. Amen. And we'll take a break.